Now, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, but even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him?" But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?"
Thanks, Karen. Please keep your Bible open there as we carry on in this series in John chapter 10 and 11. I'm going to cut straight to the chase. The first point I want to make today is there is a big problem we all face, and that is death. And as soon as I say it, I know that I'm immediately relevant, because one day we will all die. I don't know if you've ever brought up the subject of death at a dinner party or something like that. You know, say to the person sat opposite you, "Have you given any thought recently to your own death?" I'm sure the conversation in the rest of the dinner wouldn't go that well. So if you come along this evening and what I've just said is a bit of a surprise, you know, if you're thinking about death this evening, then please do forgive me in one way, but don't forgive me in another sense, because death is something, like I say, we all face. It's the ultimate statistic. One in one person dies. And we can deal with death in all sorts of ways, can't we? Our response to it can come in all sorts of different ways in different cultures. Certainly in the West, we're influenced by all sorts of various thoughts to do with death. We can respond to it with a little bit of humour. Marty Kane was a British comedian. She was actually from Sheffield. She died of cancer in the end, but when she got cancer, she said this: "Life's a dangerous matter. We won't get out of it alive." That's what Marty Kane said. Today, we are responding and reflecting upon death in terms of gratitude and in terms of honouring and acknowledging the sacrifice of people who've given their lives for the sake of others. And so that's a way in which today we are remembering people who've died. We're remembering death. And we want to honour those and be thankful for those who've given their lives for freedom today. And very grateful to what Faith said earlier on and shared from the heart, from her own experience, her brother in the war zone. That's a right thing and an appropriate thing that we do today. We can at points be just simply fascinated by death, can't we, in our culture? This year begun, 2007 begun it was an appalling frenzy, I suppose is the best way of putting it. It was the botched hanging of Saddam Hussein. And somebody somewhere in the group of people that were there to witness it, filmed it on their telephone. And then put it on the World Wide Web. And, I don't know, thousands, millions of people across the world watched the botched hanging of Saddam Hussein with a weird fascination. And for some that didn't watch it, perhaps we'd stand back and be a little bit judgmental. We have this, we talk about morbid fascination, don't we? But we have to say, well, how many of us haven't slowed down just simply because the traffic is slowing down when we're going past the rather brutal accidents on the motorway to have a rubberneck? It's death can fascinate us as well, can't it? Not just today we're thankful for people who've died, but if we can have this morbid fascination. Sometimes we just simply try to lighten it, don't we? That's another way. Perhaps in our culture in Britain we will try and lessen its seriousness. I've quoted Marty Kane. But earlier this year at the Christian Resources exhibition, there was an attempt to encourage churches to modernise funeral services and so lessen the fear of death. And so at the Christian Resources exhibition earlier this year, there was a number of things available. It featured upbeat ways of commemorating the dead, motorcycle hearses, fireworks that explode ashes into the sky, and headstones that play videos of the deceased. And to try and lighten it a little bit, I can see by your faces that some of you feel lightened, others of you just think, well, that's just weird. And some of you just go, is this guy real, what he's saying now? Yeah, that really happened. The reality is, though, is that the biggest response, the deepest response to death is bereavement, isn't it? When a loved one dies. It doesn't matter how much we try and laugh about it or avoid it. That's probably the reaction that most British people have to death, is just avoid it and hope it doesn't happen. But the reality is that we will, all of us, face the pain of death, bereavement, unless we die ourselves. Tony Benn, elder statesman of this country, British politician, has written some diaries recently, diaries dated 2001 to 2007, and the title of his diaries is More Time for Politics. Let me quote Thursday, 25th of April. In the afternoon I had a bit of a rest, and I was terribly depressed. I thought of Caroline, that's his wife, who died. Where is she? Her body, which I loved and knew so well, was taken away and burned, and she's not there. And all the things I should have done for her, all the time I should have given her, I didn't give. I think she was happy, but I'll never ever see her again till I die, and after that, who knows? And Tony Benn has actually been on radio recently, television, talking about bereavement and talking about facing the loss of the loss that he had when his wife died. Aristotle, there are all various ways that we can respond to death. So we can come to the point as well of reading people who confront death and confront it head on. Aristotle, for example, said death is a dreadful thing, for it is the end. Bertrand Russell said, when I die, I rot. That's it. So there are people in cultures around the world who face death, they face it, the reality of it, very bruising kind of thing. Well, that's it. I rot. Mainly it's atheists who'll do that, and I guess one of the kind of reactions that I have arising within me when I hear of an atheist saying, simply, when I die, I rot, I kind of like in my heart think, well, why do some people want to be atheist when it doesn't have a shred of hope? No, I mean, they might say, well, Alty, you're just avoiding the issues, aren't you? You're going for that crutch again. But to offer something that has no hope at all, well, why? What is attractive about it? The problem, death. Question is, can we face death and still have hope? Is it possible to face death and still have peace of mind and heart? Can anybody be as secure in death as in life? Now, these are big questions, aren't they? These are relevant questions. These are the questions which will come up in our lives this week. Guaranteed. Because we will read about people. We will watch television programs. We'll watch the news. We'll hear about death all week in some way, shape or form. Immediately relevant to where we are. But it is a problem. The problem of death. And so we come to Jesus, the promise, life. Jesus claimed that he could face death head on, and not hopelessly, but face death squarely and give hope. And that's at the very, very heart of the reading that Karen read to us a moment ago, chapter 11 and verses 25 to 26 in our church Bibles, page 1082. And this is Jesus, and this is how Jesus faced death. And he says this: Jesus said to her, that is to Martha, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Do you believe this? Do you believe this? What Jesus just said? It's quite staggering. We can read all the philosophers in the world right down through the centuries, and when it comes to death, in reality, they draw a complete blank. But in strides Jesus Christ, who claims, "I'm the resurrection and the life. He or she who believes in me will live even though they die." And he makes a great big promise like that that nobody else on the planet even begins to even attempt to promise. There is life, says Jesus, that you can have, that nothing will separate you from, not even death. And Jesus says, "I am the source, the absolute source of that life." Jesus makes a promise. Who does he make the promise to? He makes it, doesn't he, to those who believe. See the emphasis there in John's Gospel? Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Do you believe this? It's a promise to those who would believe, would stake their lives and their deaths upon Jesus, to those who believe, to trust, who would trust Jesus Christ, who would take him at his word, who would believe his promise that he makes. Well, in one sense, if you're an interested inquirer with us this evening, you might think, well, it's easy enough for Jesus to make a promise like that. Anybody can say whatever they want, can't they? But the big question is, can Jesus deliver on this promise? Can he back it up? He can make the promise, but anyone can do, but can Jesus actually back it up? Just notice again the setting. Some of us may not have been here last week, but the setting is real people in real circumstances in the midst of sorrow and desperate sadness. Jesus is talking and speaking to people in the midst of grief. It's just a few days after a funeral. Okay? And if any of you here, folks, those who've experienced a family funeral, those days, the day where you just feel numb, shocked, the emotions are all over the place, that's the context that this is in. That's the pastoral context that this is in, that Jesus makes this promise in. Real people in the midst of sorrow and sadness. A brother had died and had been buried. And it is to one of the dead man's sisters, a grieving woman, that Jesus makes his promise to. We realise what that means, don't we? I mean, the stakes are very, very high here, aren't they? Jesus says this to a woman who is in utter despair, utter grief. He's making this promise. I mean, if he couldn't keep it, then Jesus is a charlatan, isn't he? I mean, the title of our series is Jesus, Guru, Guy, Good God, or we could add another G. The only one I could think of that summarised it was grotesque. I mean, to make this promise, this statement to a woman in the midst of her grief, and not back it up, can only be grotesque if he can't back it up. I think grotesque could be added to the choice of who Jesus is. Is he grotesque? Just notice Jesus isn't saying that he's an optional extra at a funeral. He's not saying he's a crutch or prop you up to help things get better. Jesus claims to be absolutely essential. His promise forces us into a corner. We have to come to a conclusion about Jesus. Is he right or is he wrong? Is a right conclusion or wrong conclusion? If Jesus is wrong, then he's a charlatan. But if he's right, then he's the most important person who ever lived. Now there's no middle road. The stakes are too high. Is he charlatan? Is he grotesque? Or is he God? Well, can he deliver on the promise? Look at the events before and after. Well, just the events before Lazarus' death. We'll come to the events afterwards, after this section next week. Jesus was somewhere else, if you weren't here, just to remind you a little bit of what Matt showed us last week. Jesus was somewhere else when Lazarus fell seriously ill. Chapter 11, verses 1 to 3. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and Martha, his sisters. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sisters sent to him, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." So Jesus hears the news and he goes quickly to rush in to see his good friend who's ill. But no, that's not what he does. That's what we'd expect him to do. But as Matt showed us last week, that isn't what he does. Turn over the page, verse 5. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So he loved them so much. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he didn't rush. He stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Jesus heard the news and he doesn't go quickly running to see his sick friend that he loves. He does nothing about it. He stays where he was. Something fantastic and huge has got to be about to happen. And those of us that have read the story before, we've got to pretend we've not read it before. Because if Jesus makes this sort of statement to these people and says, "I love him so much I'm not going," something big has got to be about to happen to justify a statement like that. Something big has got to be happening to justify the promise that Jesus makes to the grieving Martha when he comes. It's riveting the way that John tells the story and how it happens. It's full with suspense and excitement if we didn't re-engage with the story, those of us that know it so well. If we didn't know that what was coming, we'd be going, "Goodness me, what is going on here?" It's thrilling, isn't it? It's exciting. It really sets up the tension for what will happen. Something gigantic is about to happen. Jesus puts Mary and Martha through all the grief and pain of bereavement and a funeral so that they and his other friends, so that you and I can believe. Believe what? Believe the promise of verses 25 and verse 26. "I am the resurrection and I am the life. He who believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die." Do you believe this? I mean, the question is, have you got anyone else to believe when it comes to death? What are the other options? Here's the promise of Jesus. What are the alternatives? When people say, "When I die, that's it," you know, on what authority do they make that claim? Well, what have they got to back up that claim? When you die, you rot, that's it. It could just be wishful thinking, couldn't it? It could be a kind of a crutch to keep you from God, because that's the last thing you want to believe in. "I am the resurrection and the life," says Jesus. "What happens after death depends on your attitude to me. Death is not the end." I was born and brought up in Africa, and I've had a couple of reasonably close encounters with venomous snakes in Africa, and one was at the age of 8. I was with our family and we were on a walk, and I was throwing a stick for our dog, which was imaginatively called Scamp, and I threw this stick and it went off the road that we were on into some reasonably deep grass, and the dog wouldn't come out. So I went in after and went to pick up the stick, right? And as I bent to pick up the stick, what I thought initially was a bird taking off wasn't a bird taking off. It was a cobra, black one, that reared up in front of me and was nearly as tall as me, as a little 8-year-old. All right, so we stood facing one another, and ooh, like that. I don't know what went through my head. I don't think anything went through my head. I just didn't think I had time. I think, ooh, like that. All right, it's just one of those moments. And my dad, I don't know why this is, but British people, when they're abroad, they still have a brolly with them. My dad had a brolly, gallantly there between the sun and snake with his brolly. That's what went through my head. Weird, Broly. Of course, there are those folks who are snake charmers, and they've got the cobra, and they've milked the poison out. The thing looks as fierce and as frightening and as deathly as it used to, but it isn't anymore. It won't kill you. It won't harm you. The death has the poison has been drawn. It's no longer a killer. And as we read John's Gospel, we see that Jesus came and died. And he came and he died to draw the sting of death. He, the innocent one, died. He drank the poison, as it were, of judgment for us guilty ones who believe in him, who trust him. Trust me, says Jesus, with the biggest problem we face, death. I promise resurrection and life for all those who do trust me. Or do you have a philosophy with a shred of evidence to sustain it that can offer what Jesus offers? If you're going to turn Jesus down, you've got to have something a lot better, haven't you? So trust him. Listen to the invitation and trust him. The problem, death. The promise, life. The person, Jesus. Jesus makes us an offer that it does all depend upon him. He doesn't say there is a resurrection. Look again at verse 25-26. He says, I am the resurrection. It's all personal. Jesus personalizes it. He doesn't talk about theory. He says, I am the resurrection. He who believes in me personally, says Jesus. Whoever lives and believes in me personally. The promise is for everyone. It is absolutely for universal, for all of us here this evening, for anyone in the world, whoever believes, but it's all completely uniquely focused in on Jesus. Believes in me. Whoever believes in me. Trust Jesus and Jesus alone. And have life, will have life. I have to say that in my experience, friends of mine who are Christians, who I know who've going through facing death, their families, if they are Christians and know and trust this promise for themselves, I don't know anybody actually. As I've met people who've got serious illness which is killing them, I don't know anybody who I've met in the aftermath of bereavement, preparing for a funeral, who's believed in Jesus, who've spoken about a doctrine or a theory of the resurrection. They don't. But every single one of them, every single one of them has spoken of Jesus personally. They've known him personally. They've taken him at his word. They've trusted the promise. It's not a theory. Jesus says, I am. Trust me. And they have. They've trusted him. And Martha's response here is interesting, isn't it? It's just striking. Again, following the story, it's wonderful the way that the story unfolds. We can see how she moves in her understanding and in her faith. So in verse 21, Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. It's kind of like she's slightly accusing him there, isn't she? You know, if you'd been here, yeah, props an element of faith, because she goes on and says, you know, even now you could still do something, but there's a sense in which, you know, Lord, if you had come, he wouldn't have died. So yes, she trusts him, but she doesn't quite trust him enough, does she? He's not played things in the way that she would have had them played. And then verse 24, Jesus says to her, Jesus replies, Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. And verse 24, Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. So she's kind of got that vague understanding at this point of some sort of resurrection on some day. It's a little bit vague in her mind. And I guess that that's actually where most people in Sheffield are. And you remember those on our fourth birthday celebration, and we had the films played up on the screen, and we talked about life and death, and it's just about most people we interviewed on the streets did speak of actually of a resurrection, and vaguely thought that of having confidence on that day. I think that's Martha here, some sort of vague understanding about some moment in the future of when there will be a general resurrection. And yes, and Lazarus, her brother, will be a part of that, I'm sure. But then Jesus makes this promise to her. And he puts it on the line to her. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe it? Verse 27, she said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. She actually is, I will state my all on you. I will trust you because you are the Christ, God's King, who's come into the world, the Son of God, the Messiah, God's promised one. You are the one who can sort death out. You come into the world to sort out the world's biggest problem, death. And that's what John, he writes the whole of his gospel, wants to bring every single one of us to read the gospel too. The back end of the book, he says, Jesus did a lot of other miracles, but these ones I've written down that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and believing have life in his name. Which is exactly where the sister of Lazarus is here now. She believes. Tanya and I have got four children, and just seeing all the various younger families coming through, it's exciting, it's thrilling, and there are all sorts of things that as parents you kind of remember. There are all sorts of things as well you kind of forget, and you're kind of glad you forget when you see some of these younger couples go through all the stresses and strains of the little ones. And for me, there are some fantastic moments when the kids were little. They were always, every single one of them, absolutely fearless when it came to throwing themselves down the stairs, when they knew that I was somewhere within reach at the bottom of the stairs. And I'm glad they don't do that now. You know, they will hurl themselves down, just assuming that I would catch them. And I never failed, thankfully, to catch any of them. And if I was in the vicinity, just go for it. And I'd have to be there. And in one sense, it looked like a blind leap of faith, but no, it wasn't. They had a confidence in me, and I might think, well, bit nuts really, because, you know, I'm under a high job here. But it wasn't a blind leap. They did trust me. And anyone here who's done a parachute jump will know what I'm saying here. There are certain things that look extreme, that actually look more dangerous than they are. They look like a blind leap of faith. My children trusted me when they leapt down the stairs. Andy's a member of our church, as I saw Andy earlier on. Andy does all sorts of extreme stuff in sports. But I've talked with him, and he actually says, what I do isn't as dangerous as what it looks. Because when he does, leaps off some cliff somewhere with his rope, he's actually measured. Well, he's got the full measurement of how much the rope will lengthen when he gets to the bottom of it, depending on how far he's fallen and his own weight. He's done all the measurements. So it looks, as he leaps, like this is, there's a nutter. But no, actual fact, he would be a nutter if he hadn't done his measurements. He's not stupid, I don't think. He's not. He's not daft. He's not a daft man. I've done, the only thing that I've done really extreme is have kids. No, I did a parachute jump, and I wouldn't have jumped out of the plane if I hadn't gone through the rigorous training and everything to make sure the parachute would open. All carefully thought through. It looked like a blind leap, but no, it wasn't. It was measured, and there were things that I could be confident in. That's Christian faith. Actually, Jesus makes a promise here, and he says, trust me. And he says, basically, it won't be a blind leap of faith. I can back up my promise. And if you want to know what the backup is, you're going to have to come back next week. And those of you who do know, you're going to have to pretend, coming back next week, that you don't know. All right? Get into the story. And so when Crofty comes and shares a little bit more of the story next week, you say, oh yeah, how does Jesus back up this promise? This is a big promise, isn't it? Just imagine being Mary or Martha. They didn't know what was going to happen. Martha, she's already trusting Jesus before the backup comes. Perhaps that's you this evening. You know Jesus can back up his own promise. And perhaps tonight's the night when you say, yes, actually, I do want to trust him. Take him at his word. Don't take my word for it. Take Jesus' word for it. It may well be that you want to find out a little bit more than you need to. Well, this evening, particularly if you speak Chinese, we've got the Chinese, we're doing Christianity Explored starting this evening in Chinese. And Paul Woods over here is helping us with that. Paul speaks Chinese. He became a Christian through the Chinese church. You were an atheist, weren't you, before over there in Manchester as a student? And a passionate atheist, and he came across some Chinese people who were as clever, if not cleverer than you, doing PhDs and the like, and they invited him to church. So he became a Christian as an Englishman through the Chinese church, and he's married to a Chinese woman, and he speaks Chinese, and so he's going to be helping folks this evening with Nadine, his wife. So it may well be that that fits for you this evening. Have a word with Bill Sheeler or Paul tonight. If you don't know Chinese, come and have a word with me at the end. And if it's another language, I'll try and find someone else who can help out. We've got someone who speaks Farsi here, then maybe that may be where you want to go through. Or Japanese. A couple of Japanese speakers here too. See if you want to think about things a little bit more. Pick up a John's Gospel at the back, they're there, and have a read. So do follow through, do respond. For those of us who are already folks who trust this promise, then it is a precious promise, isn't it? And it is a promise that I guarantee, above anything else, makes your faith relevant tomorrow morning at work, or tomorrow morning in the class with other students in the lecture, because everybody will face death at some time or another. And you and I have got something very precious to say. We've got, you know, spiritual wisdom, gold, haven't we? This is precious. This is wonderful. We'd be cheapskates to hold it back, wouldn't we? When situations, no doubt this week, we'll carry on with things in the press and around in the conversations to do with today and Remembrance Sunday, and what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. And yes, we want to honour and remember those from the past, but there's more, isn't there? We can be saying, yes, there's more than just simply honouring. Jesus talks about life beyond death. Have you thought of that? And for those who want to avoid it and feel they can't face it, we can say, if you thought about Jesus, the one who could confront it head on and offer hope. Think about that. For those who are just into the morbid fascination or just want to lessen it, then we've got so much to offer in terms of drawing alongside people who in their hearts might just be desperate and thinking, well, I just can't sort this one out. Those who fear, those who have suffered, we can draw alongside and compassionately show them the promise of Jesus. There's so much that we have in just this promise of Jesus to share with those around us. So wherever we are, whether we are interested in choirs this evening, or whether we've been walking with God, with the Lord Jesus for some time and known his promise for some time, it is a precious promise for us to respond to in some way, shape or form this evening in a way that is appropriate and relevant for us. So let's spend a moment of quiet, shall we, and just reflect where you are, reflect where you are in terms of death and your own situation, and where your colleagues are, your friends, student friends, and think upon Jesus' promise, and how do you respond in the most appropriate way